Hey there! You're about to listen to the Podfic anthology of the series Navigation, Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers, a series of, as of right now, three stories that are Stargate SG-1, Stargate Atlantis, Teen Wolf crossovers, all written by Talia Hale and all read by Rena Jenkins. This series takes place way in the future for Stargate Atlantis, Stargate SG-1, and Teen Wolf, and is pretty much the happiest place I ever could have imagined this crazy crossover going. It's so great. Podfics are in the order of, well, the series, with additional content notes and author's notes and reader's notes attached to each individual podfic. So yeah, happy listening! I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do! This is Curly Fries and Other Little Obscenities, a Teen Wolf, Stargate Atlantis, Stargate SG-1 crossover fic, written by Talia Hale and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated G, contains the pairings Laura Cadman, Aiden Ford, and Rodney McKay, John Shepard, with additional tags for Community, Into a Bar, Crossover, Alternate Universe Canon Divergence, Canon Character of Color, Walk Into a Bar, only if the commissary not a bar, Ford Deserves Happiness, Queer Gen, First Meetings, Future Fic, Scientist Styles. This is the first story in the Navigation, Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers series. Author's Notes. Thanks to my Mephis for all the encouragement. Written for A Ficathon Walks Into a Bar. My prompt? Stiles Stilinski walked into a bar and meets Aiden Ford. Unfortunately, there is no actual bar in this story. Aiden's storyline diverges from SGA canon pre-series. His grandmother fell ill, and he never joined the original expedition. He's a team leader at the SGC, and his life has been all puppies and rainbows and Cadman, instead of Wraith enzyme-induced psychosis and life on the lam. You lost, son? Stiles spins on one sneakered foot, flailing when he sees the officer standing behind him. The man's wearing rumpled BDUs bearing the SG-16 insignia, and his neatly laced boots are mottled with mauve mud. The name patch on his jacket reads, Major A. Ford. He's got a crooked smile, kind brown eyes, and a head full of close-cropped gray curls. You have no idea, Stiles mumbles. This has been the longest week of Stiles Stilinski's adult life. If you'd told him that a week ago, Stiles would have laughed. He would have laughed long and hard, then raised a hand to list. Dissertation defense, college finals, his dad's wedding, and best friend gets bitten by a homicidal rogue alpha werewolf. That was all pretty exhausting. But now he's looking at secret government operations, wormhole travel, and evil aliens. No, seriously. Evil aliens! Like he's stumbled into an episode of Farscape after a decade of Buffy. The sheriff thinks Stiles landed a job consulting with the Department of Foreign Languages at the Air Force Academy. In actuality, he's undergoing orientation and training at a top-secret military installation beneath Cheyenne Mountain. It's his first job out of school, and he's working at a secret base full of alien artifacts and technology. The best and the brightest mostly humans from around the galaxy, and more firepower than he has seen outside of the Argent's basement. And this place is huge. He got turned around somewhere between Dr. Jackson's office on level 12 and where he thought the commissary was on level 7. Until Major Ford found him, Stiles thought he was going to starve before he saw another living soul. You okay there, kid? Major Ford's grin widens when Stiles snaps back to attention. Just dandy, Major. Stiles grins back. But it's my first week on the job, and I've already gotten lost 3 times. Only 3? You're doing just fine, Mr. Major Ford extends a hand. Stilinski, Stiles supplies, shaking the offered hand. Well, it's Dr. Stilinski, technically, but that's pretty new. Plus, it makes me feel old. And nobody warned me, but if you tell people you're a doctor, they start to tell you about their physical maladies. Not that that's not interesting, obviously, but I'm an anthropologist and linguist, not an MD, so you can call me Stiles, sir. He finishes. When I'm off duty, it's just Ford, not Sir Stiles. Welcome to the SGC. Can I point you in the right direction? I'm about to pass out from hunger and lack of caffeine, so any help finding food would be great. You'll be blending in with the science stuff in no time. Ford laughs and points behind Stiles. 2 doors that way if you want the commissary. Right. Well. Stiles fiddles with the drawstrings of his Batman hoodie, trying and failing to align their lengths. That's not embarrassing or anything. Ford smiles, that crooked grin again. And Stiles has a flashback to the rueful looks Danny would give him after patrols their senior year. That look, says Stiles, is an adorably lost puppy in need of direction. Mind if I join you? Just wrapped up a 4-hour debrief and wouldn't mind some grub myself. That'd be great. Stiles waves Ford ahead, following him into the commissary, which is half full despite the late hour. There's a fair mix of white coats and uniforms, chatting over trays and stacks of official-looking documents. Any recommendations? He asks when they reach the counter. The curly fries are usually a safe bet. Ford nods at the chafing dish, helping himself to a small portion of golden fried deliciousness before filling the rest of his plate with steamed veggies and grilled chicken. They have curly fries? Maybe this place isn't so terrible. Stiles begins heaping fries onto his plate before realizing what he said. Not that I think it's terrible, obviously. New places are always an adjustment. I mean, a secret military base underneath a mountain is a bit of a culture shock after Stanford. Uh-huh. Ford shakes his head, heading towards an occupied table. At one end sits a balding man in an expensive-looking, if slightly disheveled, charcoal suit. He's seated across from an Air Force officer with salt-and-pepper hair that seems to be defying both regulation and the laws of physics, in crisply starched dress blues. Looking sharp, sir, Ford nods, taking a seat next to the general. That gets an eye roll out of the other officer, a Brigadier General J. Shepard. I never have to deal with a dress uniform at home. I hate digging this thing out of the closet, General Shepard drawls. He tugs at a stiff sleeve while Stiles settles into the seat across from Ford and next to the suited man. Stiles' neighbor is shoveling down reconstituted mashed potatoes like they're his last meal on Earth. Considering where they're sitting, it might be. Obviously Shepard's tiring of the legions of fawning fans in his old age. The suited man stabs his meatloaf with more force than seems strictly necessary. Sure, Dr. McKay. Ford grins around a mouthful of carrots. Found you a Stanford man wandering the hallways, General. No kidding. Shepard turns sharp green eyes on Stiles, who freezes with a mouthful of curly fries. John Shepard, class of 92. He extends a calloused hand across the table. Stiles gulps and nearly chokes before shaking Shepard's hand. Stiles Stilinski, I finished my undergrad in 19. My defense was 2 weeks ago. All this, he gestures around the room, is a little different from the postdoc I was planning at Berkeley. Feel the study? Dr. McKay asks. He has the brusque air of a man used to prompt, if generally disappointing, answers. Linguistics and anthropology. McKay snorts in derision, then grunts in pain when Shepard kicks him under the table. Ford ignores the entire display, as if senior staff squabbling like schoolchildren is par for the course. He squirts a wide pool of ketchup onto his plate, earning a squawk from McKay when the condiment splatters. Be nice, Rodney. You're working with Dr. Jackson, then? Shepard asks. Dr. Jackson's my direct supervisor, but he's having me cross-train with General Carter's staff. Why would Sam want another anthropologist? McKay asks, sounding more appalled than genuinely interested. Probably something to do with the undergraduate degree in mathematics and the dual masters in aeronautical engineering and applied physics. Stiles shrugs, shoving a handful of curly fries in his mouth to keep from laughing in McKay's purpling face. Why the hell did you switch? Ford tilts his head to one side and studies Stiles intently enough to set him squirming. Stiles blushes, scratching at the back of his neck. Honestly, I didn't think it would make sense to continue when there wasn't an active space program anymore, Stiles admits. All three men stare at him for a long moment, before bursting into laughter. Stiles smiles sheepishly, ducking his head and taking a sip of soda. You're very lucky to be working with Carter, McKay says, polishing off his potatoes with a wistful sigh. Not that she'll ever believe you if you tell her I said that, he adds with a broad wave of his spoon. And Dr. Jackson's not entirely incompetent. That's as close to complimentary as he gets with the soft sciences, I'm afraid. Shepard shakes his head, reaching across the table to pat McKay's hand. He snags McKay's empty tray, stacking the dirty dishes with his own before standing. Best of luck, Dr. Stilinski. Look us up if you're ever in the Pegasus Galaxy. He grins at Stiles. Ford, all our best to Laura and the kids. She says the doc owes her $20, and he'll know why, Ford says, eyes flicking to McKay. McKay stands with an indignant huff, shuffling until he's brushing shoulders with Shepard. You tell her, he begins, before Shepard catches his eye and raises a judgmental brow. Tell her she still owed me 20 for the over-under on Zelenka's pigeons, so now we're even. Come on, Rodney. You've got a cottage at the Broadmoor, and the 500-count sheets are calling my name. Shepard heads for the waste station with the trays. Yes, yes, I just gotta find your lackey in the motor pool and we can go. Ford, Stilinski. McKay nods, following Shepard out of the commissary. Was that... Did they travel to another galaxy for a vacation? Ford nods, shoveling down another forkful of veggies. Have you met Dr. Madison Miller? Stiles nods. His first day, Stiles met a baby-faced blonde with serious blue eyes and a knack for shouting down Marines while working magic with a wrench. She reminds him a lot of Lydia, actually. Well, if Lydia would deign to wear coveralls and a slightly charred bandana over her hair. She's the doc's niece. They were in town for her wedding. Stiles mouths, in town, and tries to wrap his head around all this. Huh. And he may have only been here for a week, but he's read the few unclassified and frankly, mind-blowing, publications by M. Rodney McKay, Ph.D., Ph.D. Plus, the man's a program legend, so... Holy shit. I just met Dr. McKay, and there was no yelling. Yeah. Ford laughs at the shell-shocked expression on Stiles' face. I thank God and Grandma Agnes every day I didn't go with the original expedition. Admittedly, there's less yelling now. He's mellowed with age. That was mellow? Oh, yeah. Ford smiles, setting his fork next to his empty plate. I spent a couple months on a TDA to Atlantis when Carter and McKay first got the gate breach up and running. That's when McKay set me up with my wife, actually. Anyway.
He waves a dismissive hand.
Back then, I wouldn't have been surprised if he told me Doc had an aneurysm from dealing with incompetent minions. He and the General started meditating after McKay's blood pressure got out of control a few years back. Seems to do a surprising amount of good. I guess Tilk taught him a few Kilnareem tricks.
I understood nothing about what you just said, Stiles says, shrugging out of his hoodie.
But I just met one of my academic heroes. Also, I'm eating curly fries, and I didn't blow up anything in any of the labs. I'm declaring today a success. You have a low bar for success, kid.
Ford eyes the patchwork of scars running up Stiles' bared forearms.
Got a penchant for trouble? More for getting out of it, actually.
Stiles takes a long pull on his Mountain Dew.
My hometown's not the safest place, and I'm not a fan of bullies. I can respect that. Have they got you enrolled in any weapons training?
Test it out. Stiles shakes his head.
Ford looks pleasantly surprised. Of everything?
Everything except the weird snake guns and a couple of the blue glowy thingies.
Hand to hand?
All set. You guys sort of overtrain the science staff, considering we're snugly tucked under a literal mountain of protection.
We have a tendency to recruit civilians and send them into the field where anything can happen.
So the weapons training's preparation for occupational hazards? Stiles laughs.
Good to know. You interested in joining an SG team?
Ford tilts his head to the side, leaning back in his chair.
Are you kidding? Of course! But Dr. Lee said not to expect off-world opportunities to come up much in my field of expertise. I can bide my time. How's next week sound?
Stiles splutters, sending a spray of yellow soda across the remains of his dinner.
I'm sorry,
he manages through a fit of coughing.
The debrief I just got out of. My cultural expert is going to be on medical leave with a broken ankle. I've got a vital mission negotiating with some medical researchers that joined the colony on P4X650. Rescheduling isn't really an option. If I get the go-ahead from Dr. Jackson, are you interested?
Am I? Yeah. I mean, yes, that would be... Yes, sir. I'm interested.
Great. Report to level 14 at 0700 Monday morning. I'll get you signed into the range designated for alien weaponry training.
Ford stands, lifting his tray.
And maybe wear some shoes with a little more grip, kid.
Stiles watches, mouth agape, as Ford deposits his tray and exits the commissary. He slumps in his chair, idly twirling a curly fry as he considers the events of the day.
When Stiles thinks about it, this isn't nearly as strange as... There's an alien weaponry training facility on level 14?
The end.
Can't you see? Little girl got a hold on me like glue. Baby, I'm howling for you. Yeah. Throw the ball to the stick. Swing and miss and the catcher's mitt strike too. Baby, I'm howling for you.
Reader's notes. I had to
stop recording 6 times so far just to clap my feet together. I love this universe so much, it makes me so happy. Don't forget to check out parts 2 and 3 of this series, Navigation, Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers. And find out more about the adventures of Teen Wolf SGA SG-1 crossover awesome sauce! The cover art for this podfic was designed by the incredibly amazing Green Iron, who just, above and beyond anything I could have imagined, wee baby Styles with his "this is my very serious face" and Ford looking on so paternally. Oh, I love it! So don't forget to leave some awesome feedback for Green Iron in this amazing cover art. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.
Together we can see what we will find. Don't leave me alone at this time, for I'm afraid of what I will discover inside.
This is Beneath an Unfamiliar Sky, a Teen Wolf, Stargate Atlantis, Stargate SG-1 crossover thing. Written by Talia Hale and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated PG-13, contains the pairing Stiles Stilinski, Derek Hale, with additional tags for pre-slash, alternate universe, canon divergence, canon character of color, crossover. Of course Stiles has the ATA gene, and is a little in love with the puddle jumpers. Off-world, Deputy Derek Hale. Derek is not a Goa'uld! The ladies at the SGC are better than you. Future Fic, post-season 3A, Scientist Styles. This story is the second in the Navigation Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers series. Author's notes. To my knowledge, there are no maple leaf patterned Moby wraps, but they should totally get on that. Very Canadian mommy culture.
You told me that I would find a home within the fragile substance of my soul, and I have filled this void with things unreal, and all the while my character it steals.
Styles spent the last 8 days sharing a hut with his teammates and a handful of goat-like creatures on P7K172. Dad's going to be pissed he missed Thanksgiving. The Avanans are technologically primitive, even amongst the peoples of the Milky Way, but their planet's unique position garnered the SGC's attention a decade ago. As one of the designated science teams, SG-16 makes bi-monthly trips escorting science staff through the underwater gate in Puddle Jumper 7. Unfortunately, the periodic warming and cooling caused by the binary stars results in unpredictable seismic and volcanic activity. The seismologists stationed at the SGC's Avanan base have been working on predictive models, but have been, as yet, unsuccessful. They're further behind now. The last week was spent using the base's 2 jumpers, SGC Jumper 7, and a makeshift submersible bulldozer, to clear enough wreckage to pilot a ship through the gate without collapsing any vital surface structures.
I don't get why you're itching to leave, Stilinski.
Ford leans on the mallet he uses to pound fence posts into the loamy soil.
Barn raising and fencing in goat thingies is practically a vacation after our last few missions.
He grins crookedly at Styles, swinging the nickel mallet over his shoulder.
Or do you not remember the High Priestess of the last great Wangdoodles on PJ3, whatever the hellhole was? Okay. They could be stuck somewhere way worse than Ivana. Baby Styles is a little jealous that he and Ford are farmhands until they can get home. It's important work, and Styles is happy to help, but the rest of the team is busy doing, well, cool stuff. Captain Calliope, just call me Callie, Taylor, started her career with the 820th Red Horse Squadron out of Nellis. General Carter snapped her up 5 years ago for Area 51, and then transferred her to Stargate Command when Cadman started working as a consultant and opted out of regular missions. Callie could lead the gate excavation in her sleep. Dr. Madison Miller, their usual fourth, was due back from maternity leave the day after their planned return. The last 6 days have seen her berating everyone for their general incompetence and specific failings via video transmission. She's no less terrifying with a snoring newborn strapped to her chest. Madison's stand-in, Kavya Patenkar, a Canadian civil engineer with a background in heritage preservation, was snapped up by the natives to design a new water wheel for their gristmill. No, I have not forgotten P3J whatever. The Ivanans have been great, Styles admits. He's annoyed with himself for sleeping soundly on an alien planet. Every night he's exhausted down to his bones, drowsy and content with a belly full of warm stew and bread baked with flour from the new mill. High school Styles would be appalled by his lack of vigilance.
They make a mean harada cake, Ford says, eyes glazing over for a moment.
That they do. Styles can almost taste the lingering roasted pumpkin spicy maple cashew flavor of last night's sticky buns. Plus, their council's granted me access to all the written histories, so I've got scans to take back to Dr. Jackson. If I had to be trapped in another solar system, planet P7K172 gets 4.5 out of 5 puddle jumpers.
Where'd they lose the half?
Ford asks, nudging a goat thing to halt its assault on his bootlaces.
The straw tick mattress has been murder on my back, Styles says.
Ugh, listen to me, I sound like McKay. He sticks his tongue out when Ford laughs and writes another fence post. It's all fine, but I promised my dad I'd be home for the holiday. He's gonna get worried if he doesn't hear from me. Yeah, I heard you mention that in the last transmission. You know, in that blissful but brief break between actual orders and Maddie insulting Kavanaugh's parentage, hairstyle, and sexual inclinations. They're going to send an email from your address saying a work thing came up and you'll be home as soon as you can. Relax, kid. There's nothing to worry about. Styles chews absently at his lip before pounding another post into the ground.
You're probably right.
Major Ford was not right. Styles is still running Jumper 7's post-mission diagnostic. And no, he is not overly attached, but he's got the ATA gene and she likes him. Doesn't zap him after long hauls like she does some of the gate techs. When General Carter places a firm hand on his shoulder. Dr. Stilinski, if you could follow me. It's not a suggestion. Styles shares a startled look with Callie, whose brown eyes are darting from Styles to Carter. Is there a problem, General? Callie asks, gaze fixing on the fingers splayed across Styles' uniform. Yes, with me, Stilinski. General Carter releases him and heads through the open blast door, clearly expecting him to follow. Styles stands and scrambles after her. He only avoids tripping on the ramp when Maddie yanks him up right by the elbow. She's gorgeous, by the way, Styles calls over his shoulder to Dr. Miller, whose infant daughter is drooling peacefully in a maple leaf Moby wrap. Styles and Carter are in the eerily quiet elevator headed to level 25, before the General speaks again. Someone came looking for you while your team were isolated on P7K172. Like someone showed up at my apartment? Styles ventures. Like someone showed up at the entrance to the mountain and demanded he be taken to you, Carter says, before stepping through the elevator doors. Is this... Am I being taken to an interrogation room? Because I'll take a polygraph. I've never broken the NDA I signed when I joined the SGC, and... Open the door. Carter orders the mountainous sergeant standing guard. If you didn't tell him where you work... Then how did he know you were here? She asks, as the door buzzes and slides open. I have no idea. Nobody knows I'm... Oh. Styles blinks, staring at the room's single occupant. Well, he probably followed my scent. Really subtle, Styles, Derek snaps, leaning as far back in his chair as he can manage, while cuffed to the table. Just FYI, General... Styles enters the room, spinning the second chair so he can sit astride it. Those cuffs are only on out of courtesy. Deputy Hale here can break out of them anytime he wants. Styles, Derek says, through gritted teeth, eyes fixed on Carter. So you admit you've disclosed the location of our base of operations to a Goa'uld? Carter's tone is icy. Whoa, hey, no, that's not... And now Styles is getting the picture. He looks from Derek, innocent looking enough in his khaki uniform, sans sidearm, to Carter, whose arms are crossed over her chest. She looks like she'd enjoy nothing more than sending Derek and Styles through a space gate. General Carter, you can't think Derek's... Deputy Hale is not an alien! Not an alien? Derek scowls at Styles as if that'll make him stop joking. When Styles and Carter continue to glare at each other, Derek says, Styles, what kind of trouble have you gotten yourself into? And now Derek's staring at Styles like maybe he's an alien. Like you can talk about trouble, Styles says. I can't believe you tracked me to a top-secret military installation, you crazy stalker person! What were we supposed to do? The chains attaching Derek to the table creak ominously as the deputy waves his hands. We received a falsified email and no one was able to make direct contact with you. How did you know we faked the email? Carter asks, shifting slightly forward as the scientist side of the officer briefly takes over. We set up a verification system years ago. Derek shakes his head dismissively. And I swear I'm not that gold or whatever thing you were saying. Styles, they saw my eyes. They saw... Well, shit. Styles ponders this piece of information, resting his chin on the back of his chair, fingers tapping restlessly against his knees. I don't think we can hand-wave that one away, Derek. General, I swear to you, he's not a Goa'uld. He'll willingly submit to a medical examination that will prove he doesn't have a symbiote. Right, Derek? Right. Wait, have a what? Well, good news. Dr. Jennifer Keller smiles, brushing back a stray strand of silvering blonde hair. She looks up from her tablet and says, I can definitively say that he's not a Goa'uld. Thank you! Styles hops up from his stool. He eyes the restraints still attaching Derek to the hospital bed. Can we lose the cuckoo's nest accoutrement now? Just a minute, Dr. Stilinski. Dr. Keller puts a gentle hand on his forearm. He doesn't have a symbiote, but Deputy Hale shows too much genetic variation to be a Tauri human. That's because I'm not human, Derek says, completely unhelpfully. Everyone in the room turns to stare at him. Styles drops back onto his stool and hisses, Shut up! Shut up! Styles grips Derek's left hand below the leather cuff, anchoring him to the bed. You idiot, they're going to lock you up in Area 51 and throw away the key! Incompetence like Greenberg will slice and dice you into itty-bitty pieces. Derek suffers from delusions, General Carter. He sometimes believes he's a pineapple. Styles. Derek's grip on Styles' hand tightens. A pineapple? Really? That's what you're going with?
To Dr. Keller, he adds, I'm a shapeshifter. It runs in the family. Nearly all of us could.
Really?
Dr. Keller sounds fascinated rather than disgusted or frightened. Stiles is sending a massive muffin basket to the SGC's head of HR. Nothing phases these people. Keller pulls a stylus from her pristine lab coat and begins scribbling notes onto Derek's e-medical file. So, could would imply it's something you normally grow out of? In lieu of Derek's reply, Stiles explains. He means he's the only one left. His eyes are fixed on Derek's face, which is carefully blank. Oh. Dr. Keller's hand freezes. She pulls off her reading glasses and looks at Derek with watery brown eyes. Oh, Deputy Hale, I'm sorry, I didn't mean...
It's fine, Dr. Keller.
Derek's death grip on Stiles' hand looses infinitesimally.
I wasn't clear.
It's not fine, Derek, Jesus! Stiles snaps. You don't owe them any answers!
I tracked you to a secret government installation way outside of my jurisdiction and demanded entrance.
Derek replies, the hint of a grin tugging at the corners of his mouth.
I definitely owe them some answers.
Look, just, can we at least uncuff him?
Stiles asks, directing his request to General Carter.
Please?
We had a chance to look over Deputy Hale's records while Jennifer was running her tests, Carter says, glancing at her own tablet. One arrest, but no official charges filed. Near perfect scores at the academy. The recommendation letter from one Dr. Deaton describes you as a pillar of the Beacon Hills community and a friend upon whom any and all may rely.
Derek flushes deeply, avoiding Stiles' pleased grin.
You've been an exemplary member of the Beacon County Sheriff's Department for the past 6 years. Excellent reviews from your supervisors, particularly a... what was it? A Sheriff John Stilinski. The general's blue eyes zero in on Stiles before studying Derek's downturned face. It seems this isn't the only place where those given a second chance surpass all expectations. Keller, Derek, and Stiles all stare at Carter. You can remove the restraints, Dr. Keller. As Keller scrambles to comply, Carter raises an eyebrow in challenge and says, Stilinski, if you get him to sign the NDA, I can have him transferred to the SGC before Christmas.
What exactly is the SGC?
Derek frowns.
Oh, Derek!
Stiles grins.
You're gonna love this!
The end.
Seems that all my bridges have been burnt. You say that's exactly how this grace thing works. It's not the long walk home that will change this heart, but the welcome I receive with the restart.
Reader's notes. I love this one too so much! Future fic where everyone is still alive except for the people who died, but that's okay because everybody is still alive and happy and competent, and Sam being badass in front of everybody. And Dr. Keller isn't Dr. Barbie anymore except for how she is because she's so small, but she's the head of medical and she's so awesome. I might have had to stop recording this to tweet about how many times I had said meep while I was reading this the first time. So if you follow me on Twitter, that might have been something you saw today or last week, because I'm probably not posting this for a couple days. Weird. It's like a time capsule. Anyway, the cover art for this podfic was made by the incredibly fantastic Green Iron, who just... Okay, it's called Beneath an Unfamiliar Sky, and she literally stuck Stiles on a strange planet where most of the cover is an unfamiliar sky. It's just like, oh, my brain, I love it so much. So thank you so much, Green Iron, for making this for me. And don't forget, listener, to leave some comment there about how much you thought the cover art was fantastic.
Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.
The sun, he is a real lover of making up the past and feeling up his girl like he's never felt a figure before.
This is not a war story. A Teen Wolf, Stargate Atlantis, Stargate SG-1 crossover fic. Written by Talia Hale and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated PG-13. And contains the following pairings: Rodney McKay, John Shepherd, Taylor Amagan, Kanan, Ronan Dex, Amelia Banks, Roddick Zelenka, Laura Cadman, Aiden Ford, Madison Miller, Torin Amagan, Derek Hale, Stiles Stalinski, with additional tags for Alternate Universe, Canon Divergence, Alternate Universe, No DADT, Canon Character of Color, Crossover, Slice of Life, Team Fic, Retirement, Future Fic. The ladies at the SGC are better than you. Peace breaks out in the Pegasus Galaxy. Accidental Confession of Love. Old Dudes in Love. Community, Romancing McShep. This is the third story in the Navigation, Love Songs for 21st Century Cartographers series. Author's Notes. Written for Romancing McShep, a John Rodney happy endings fest. This fic could theoretically carry a very soft M rating. If old dudes kissing and frottage offends you, don't read this. Beta by the always brilliant S. The change of command ceremony is loosely based on U.S. Air Force traditions and Star Trek The Next Generation. Warnings for non-graphic descriptions of injuries and a heart attack. Canonical character deaths are alluded to, but not specifically discussed. It's not explicitly stated, but it's made clear that John has PTSD. Relates to an AU take on scenes from Phantoms. Aforementioned horny old dudes, meddling with both canon timelines for convenience, tooth-rotting fluff, Cadman. Cadman's a warning all on her own.
A jaw-dropper. Looks good when he walks, is the subject of their talk. He would be hard to chase, but good to catch, and he could change the world with his hands behind his back. Oh, you can find him He's been there for hours, and you can tell that he'll be there for life.
John wakes up to Rodney sprawling across two-thirds of the bed, same as he has nearly every day for 25 years. He crawls out from beneath Rodney's arm with less grace than he used to, pausing for a stretch that sends a cracking down the length of his spine. Rodney grumbles and rolls over, mashing his face into the burgundy flannel of his pillowcase. He mumbles something about potatoes, or possibly particle accelerators, and then settles down to the important work of snoring fit to wake the dead. Or maybe just the birds on the balcony railing. John stands and watches Rodney sleep for a long moment. Something warm and achingly familiar settles in his chest. Today is the day. John pads barefoot to their ensuite, perfunctorily washes his face and gives his teeth a thorough brushing. He briefly considers his hair, silvered strands as wild as they ever were, before giving it up as a lost cause. He tugs on a fresh t-shirt and running pants before slipping his feet into worn sneakers. Casting one final, fond glance at Rodney's slumbering figure, he heads out the door. Ronan's waiting down the hall, performing his usual battery of painful-looking stretches. They exchange a wordless nod before setting off at a brisk jog. It's the same route they've run for 28 years. 2 miles to the east pier, roundabout loop over the catwalk, sidetrack towards the main lab, back to the residential wing in the central tower. Ronan deposits John at his doorstep, sweaty and smiling. He sketches a quick wave before jogging down the hall to the suite of rooms he shares with Amelia, Roddick, and the youngest of their 6 kids.
"And you're standing out here grinning like an idiot at the empty hallway. Why?"
Rodney slumped against the doorway. His sandy hair is sticking up in fluffy tufts, and his blue eyes have the shine they rarely get before his first cup of coffee. In lieu of answering, John backs Rodney inside and presses him flush against the wall next to the door. He swipes a quick hand across the panel, and the door shuts with a soft, obedient whoosh.
"Ah, well, that explains that,"
Rodney smirks, parting his knees so John can slot a leg into place.
"Good morning."
"Good morning,"
John replies, voice still rough with disuse. Rodney shivers and tilts his head back against the wall.
"Have you had enough real coffee for this?"
"Today I would have been up for this with no real coffee,"
Rodney says.
That's all the answer John needs before giving his hips a tight roll that has him lining up and pressing together in all the best places. Rodney's gasping wetly into the stubbled line of John's jaw, every puff of air a searing brand on his skin. John grins as Rodney strains against the hand securing his wrists above his head.
"Today I would have been up for you waking me before your morning constitutional, you ridiculous man!"
Rodney gasps when John's free hand worms its way inside the 2 small USAF sweatpants he stole from John years ago.
"I would think you were the hottest thing in 2 galaxies, even if you got paunchy and went bald. Why do you still feel the need to..."
And then John silences Rodney in the only way he's found effective in 30 years. John has never forgiven Rodney for kissing him for the first time with Laura Cadman's mouth.
So that's not entirely true, but he wishes it happened differently all the same.
Laura's gorgeous and funny and everything, but considering John's type is pretty firmly Rodney-shaped, she's not his cup of tea.
"I swear to God, you better live through this so I can kick your ass for that, McKay,"
John said. His hands still hovered, useless, a few inches from Cadman's shoulders. He glared into eyes that were wrong, hazel instead of piercing blue. They widened slightly, and then the open expression on Cadman's freckled face shuddered.
John became abruptly aware that he was looming over his D.O. Then there was some scowling from Cadman and Elizabeth, some zapping with Zelenka's machine, and Laura and Rodney were deposited on the lab floor, whole, and transferred to Gurney's. After a thorough examination, Beckett pronounced them stable, but unlikely to wake for a while. John sent Ronan and Taylor to bed, and was lounging in a torture device masquerading as a chair when McKay woke up. "Colonel," Rodney said stiffly, refusing to meet John's eyes. "I wanted you to know that I apologize for my behavior earlier today. Before you hit me, I'd like to point out that I've been under a great deal of mental stress and had to spend the last few days in that." He glared at Cadman, who was drooling peacefully into her pillow. "So I don't really see how you could hold me responsible for..." "Rodney." John gripped Rodney's chin, forcing him to look up and meet John's eyes. "I was pissed I might not get a chance to kiss you as you. Not because it was you doing the kissing." He paused, taking in Rodney's puzzled frown. "Do you get what I mean?" "I think so." "You're a genius, McKay." John smiled, leaning forward. "You'll figure it out." When Cadman woke up, she threw her drool-sodden pillow at them and threatened to set off the fire suppression system. John was only a little embarrassed their teammate caught them making out in the infirmary. Rodney just looked smug.
"Good morning, John. Rodney." Taylor looks radiant in some sort of traditional Athosian dress, all interwoven pieces of vibrant fabric that somehow pleases the eye when it should probably register as blinding. Maybe John's just gotten used to it. She's in their usual spot near the open balcony doors, still steaming tea, and the remnants of an almost chocolate banana muffin rest on the table in front of her.
"Morning, Taylor."
John sets his tray down across from her.
His breakfast is a much less exciting egg white omelet and apple juice. Last time he went in for his physical, Carson started making noises about his cholesterol, so he and Rodney are both on the health food wagon.
"That's a lovely dress."
"Thank you, John."
Taylor smiles beatifically.
"Yes, yes, you're the most beautiful woman in Pegasus. We're all very shocked and surprised you've aged so well."
Rodney sits next to John, who kicks him none too gently.
"Ow! Jesus, are you wearing steel-toed boots today? Taylor knows what I mean."
He turns to Taylor.
"You know what I mean, right?"
"Yes, Rodney." Taylor laughs. "It is safe to say that after many years of acquaintance, I have grown to accept your intended compliments in your particular style without taking offense."
"That means you're a jackass, but she's known you long enough not to care,"
Ronan says, helpfully, setting down a tray laden with everything the mess has on offer.
John and Rodney both eye the tray's contents mournfully before tucking into their heart-healthy meals.
"Are you ready for today?" Taylor asks, sipping delicately at her tea.
"Yes, I've already arranged for the transfer of the new equipment, and John's seen to the allocation of housing for the new personnel,"
Rodney says, around a mouthful of the Pegasus answer to spinach. It's purple, and thus even more unfortunate if caught between teeth. John passes Rodney a toothpick and keeps chewing without missing a beat.
"That is not what I meant, Rodney." Taylor rolls her eyes. "He knows what you meant," John says.
"Of course." Taylor nods and leans back in her chair. "I myself am looking forward to seeing Torin and my granddaughter."
"I'm looking forward to the new Marvel movie,"
Ronan says.
John should be less surprised that Ronan's still obsessed with superhero films. "This Professor Magneto guy sounds cool." "Professor Xavier!" Rodney sighs. "I showed you the wiki. You're just messing it up now to irritate me." Is it working?
Ronan quirks an eyebrow. Rodney scowls into his wheat bran, but doesn't reply.
So what's the under-over on me messing up my lines today?
John asks the table at large.
John, Taylor chides, I am sure no one is...
Roddick's got 4-1 odds,
Ronan cuts in.
He's your husband. Can you really do nothing about that?
Rodney asks.
Ronan gives Rodney his best blank stare.
It's pretty good.
Why would I want to do that?
Rodney huffs and poorly conceals a smile behind his travel mug of decaf.
John loves weekly team breakfast.
Rodney knew John's brain wasn't the friendliest place. He's not exactly fond of psychobabble, but it was always pretty obvious, at least to anyone with a modicum of intelligence. What with the night terrors, and the months it took John to readjust to the idea that someone touching him in the night was not a wraith, or an insurgent, or whatever bad guys tried to hurt John before Rodney even came into the picture.
It's also possible that Rodney hacked the service records and SGC dossiers of every high-ranking member of the mission before they stepped through the gate for the first time. Shepard's service record reads like a series of nightmares in bland military jargon.
The psychovals aren't much better.
John's been shot down and taken captive and tortured, and a whole lot of really redacted shit dotted throughout a storied career with the USAF. He's seen action on every continent on Earth, and plenty of planets in Pegasus. Of course, knowing all of that intellectually is a far cry from having his boyfriend shoot him during a Wraith mind-manipulator-induced hallucination.
You shot me!
Rodney said, for possibly the 100th time in 10 minutes.
And I said I was sorry, Rodney.
John was kneeling opposite Beckett, holding a pressure bandage in place against Rodney's very manly, very painful wound.
He shot me too, McKay,
Ronan offered in commiseration.
And I'm sorry about shooting everyone, okay?
John said, looking pale and more than a little wild about the eyes. Rodney curled his bloodied fingers around John's steady, clammy hands and squeezed.
We know. And I'll forgive you just as soon as we're home and our resident voodoo shaman shoots me up with the good drugs,
he added to Carson, who rolled his eyes and tapped Rodney's bandage into place.
You're allergic to most of the good drugs, Rodney,
Carson said, moving to check on Taylor's leg wound.
But I'll see what I can do.
John Shepard never expected to grow old with Rodney McKay. To be fair, John never expected to grow old, period. If he had, spending his twilight years in a galaxy he's helped rid of life-sucking alien vampires wouldn't have been high on the list of possibilities anyway.
Or making 2-star. Hell, making Colonel had been a big enough shock.
He figures saving a couple of galaxies from imminent death is worth something, even to the Air Force establishment. They're neither of them young men anymore. John's knees are the handiwork of the finest Atlantean engineering, and they still ache when the worst of the winter storms come in. His skin's a veritable patchwork of scars. When they're lying on Rodney's ridiculous prescription mattress, blunt-tipped fingers trace across the numerous imperfections. There's the feeding mark at the center of his chest. The erratus bugs bite at his neck. The remnants of Elia's attempt to feed on his arm. Not to mention the array of smaller marks from knives, shrapnel, scalpels, arrows, bullets, and, on one memorable occasion, Torin's rattle. Rodney's a stone lighter now than when they met. There's a precise scar on his chest where Carson cut him open after that terrifying,
if theoretically mild, heart attack. His broad shoulders and strong arms look much the same, but his middle has started to sag with weight loss and age, and his pants never sit quite right. John still loves the solidity of Rodney's frame, the way Rodney can curl around John and make him feel small and safe. There are things John never thought he could have. Rodney's breath, sleep warm against the back of his neck as they doze to the susurration of the waves outside their balcony door. Rodney's ring, a sleek band of a metal not unlike titanium but not found in the Milky Way, wrapped around John's bony finger. Rodney's hand, clasped in his as they stand in the gate room, waiting for Madison and the team of children who will take charge of their city's day-to-day operations.
"Well, look who finally decided to grace us with her presence,"
Rodney says, but his tone is tellingly soft, and the ghost of a smile plays at the corners of his mouth.
"Some of us aren't experts at traveling light,"
Madison smiles, ignoring Rodney when he begins barking out orders to the people pouring through the open wormhole. Madison releases her hold on Meredith's hand and steps into John's welcoming embrace.
"Good to see you, Uncle John."
She takes a half step back, smoothing the lapels of John's jacket. "How is he?" she asks, voice lowered as her blue eyes dart toward Rodney.
"Himself," John says,
bending down with a creak of ancient knees to smile at his grandniece.
"And how's the most beautiful girl in two galaxies?"
"Hungry," Meredith giggles, letting John scoop her up and rest her on his hip.
"It's entirely possible we have something special in the mess for you," John says, tapping her on the tip of her upturned nose.
"Cake?"
Meredith's eyes grow wide. "It's a distinct possibility," John nods.
"Are you already bribing my child with sugar, John Shepherd?"
Doran asks, wrapping an arm around Madison's waist with a smile. "He'll never prove a thing, right, Mare?"
John lets Meredith slide to the floor to wrap herself around Madison's legs with a shy grin.
"Good to be home?"
he asks Torin, whose eyes are searching the crowd for his mother's bright head.
"Home is where my family dwells,"
Torin offers. He releases his wife and moves forward to greet John with the traditional Athosian head tilt.
"Well, then home it is,"
Madison nods, detaching Meredith from her pant leg and sweeping her up in one smooth motion.
"Well, aren't you just the model of a modern major general?"
"You sing that song and I'm busting you back to private,"
John laughs, offering Cadman his hand. She brushes his hand aside and wraps him in a rib-crushing embrace, one tiny fist pounding heartily against his back.
"Civilian now, remember?"
Laura says, releasing him.
"Once a Marine,"
John shrugs, running a hand through his hair.
"I really thought you would have lost at least a little bit of that by now,"
Ford says, stepping up with one of the twins clinging to his back.
John's never been able to tell Logan and Lucas apart. "It's downright mean of you to have that much hair when McKay..."
"Don't even think of finishing that sentence," Rodney snaps, exiting the morass of bodies sorting the new equipment and supplies.
"Well, isn't this a cheerful little reunion?"
"Oh, stow it, McKay."
Laura wraps Rodney in a hug, and John can't help but notice she's much gentler with his husband.
"News travels fast at the SGC. There's a whole thing about gossip traveling faster than the speed of light and accelerating with proximity to wormholes, but that's usually when he starts tuning Roddick out. You know you've been dying to see me."
"Yes, yes."
Rodney waves a dismissive hand, but his cheeks are flushed when she releases him.
"Getting the band back together is my fondest, dearest dream. I think the birds are singing in the distance, etc. Where's my namesake, huh?"
"Right here, Uncle Mare."
Meredith waves from her mother's embrace.
Well, that can't possibly be right.
Rodney Mock scowls.
You're far too big and beautiful to be named after me.
Meredith giggles and hides her face in Madison's shoulder.
Hey, Uncle Rodney. Madison moves forward, wrapping her free arm around Rodney's middle and busting a quick kiss to his cheek. It's good to see you.
You saw me 2 weeks ago. You haven't even had time to miss me,
Rodney replies, going for dismissive and missing by a mile. Of course, Dr. McKay. Torin moves into the space his wife vacates. Rodney submits to an Athosian greeting with some semblance of good humor.
Well,
Rodney brusquely shakes Aiden's hand, then turns to look at John.
Cake?
Cake, John agrees, eyes crinkling as he smiles. Come on, I thought you were happy they're sending more grunts to help out with the bridge.
John elbowed Rodney in the side. They were waiting for the new and temporary expedition members, leaning on the balcony railing overlooking the gate.
My idea of a good time is breaking in a whole new slew of morons so they don't get themselves, or worse, us, killed,
Rodney griped.
They can't be that bad,
John said, as the gate activated in a familiar rush of noise.
Off-world activation, Sergeant Campbell called toward Elizabeth's office. General Landry's IDC.
Lower the iris, Elizabeth said, striding into command with a smile on her face.
Open a channel. Dr. Weir, this is General Landry.
General, we're ready to receive new personnel, Elizabeth replied.
Personnel incoming,
Landry said, moments before crates of supplies emerged from the gate. Cadman and Bates were below, directing incoming travelers, when a figure in SG-16 BDUs tumbled through the gate to land flat on his ass.
That was unexpected, the Marine said, linking up with a dazed smile on his face.
Smooth landing, Lieutenant,
Cadman laughed, offering him a hand up.
It's my first intergalactic gate, ma'am,
Lieutenant Ford replied.
Rougher skies than expected.
I'll just bet,
she smiled, still clasping his hand.
Oh, this'll end well,
John muttered to Rodney with a roll of his eyes.
Well, I don't know.
Rodney tilted sideways, lining up their shoulders so their upper arms were pressed firmly together. John shot an amused grin his way.
I think they might make a cute couple.
That was the catalyst for Rodney's one and only attempt at matchmaking.
It was an unmitigated success, obviously.
John's met all of Ford's team members over the years. They're a smart, if green, selection of the Stargate program's preferred collection of misfit toys. John remembers the trip to Earth for Madison and Torin's second wedding.
The food was terrible. To Rodney's horror, Jeannie and Caleb never got over the vegetarian thing.
So he and Rodney hit up the commissary at the SGC.
I.e., Rodney wanted an excuse to eat on base and harass Carter for a while.
That's when they met the Stalinsky kid. Sharp and funny, if a bit uncoordinated.
Calliope Taylor tagged along on a goodwill mission John got roped into on some godforsaken Milky Way planet.
That adventure came complete with a malfunctioning ancient outpost. He likes any engineer who keeps him from getting blown up. Kavya Patenkar was Madison's maternity leave substitute before transferring to a permanent position on Atlantis. Now she's on AR-13 and is John's regular go partner.
John has never and will never be much of a people person, but he likes Ford's team just fine. He's not entirely sure about this Derek Hale guy, and he says as much. Old friend of Stalinsky's. He was a sheriff's deputy in California for a few years before Carter appropriated him.
Ford shrugs, taking another bite of carrot-ish cake, with not unlike cream cheese frosting.
So what if the cake is purple and the cream cheese comes from a creature that most closely resembles a kangaroo? It's delicious. Appropriated?
John is watching the children's table. And yes, he feels he's earned the right to call them all children. Just look at that youthful vivacity. It's sickening. There's no way they were younger than Madison's team when the expedition first came to Pegasus. Hale is staring back at John with an amused expression. He bends slightly, but doesn't look away when Stiles speaks to him. John considers it a pretty impressive feat, considering how the scientist's arms are waving wildly to punctuate whatever point he's making.
"He sort of tracked Stilinski to the SGC," Laura says, sounding tickled.
"You know, overprotective boyfriend, Shep. And he can hear you, Aiden, you know this. Hell knows it's rude to listen in. Anything embarrassing he hears is entirely his fault." Ford's smile is more than a little mischievous. "Shall we tell the story of Derek's first contact with an off-world female, or— Hey! Using your superpowers to throw food is cheating."
Ford wipes off the piece of cake that's just landed on his cheek.
"And it's a waste of cake,"
Laura snickers, taking a sip of coffee.
"His superpowers?"
John asks.
"Did you not read any of the new personnel files?"
Rodney asks, setting down his plate and slipping into the empty chair across from John.
"Why would I?"
That earns him an irritated huff and a kick to his left ankle.
"Ow! Be gentle, Rodney. I'm getting delicate in my old age, remember?"
"That's not what you were saying this morning, old man."
Rodney smirks.
John's ears redden, but he's smiling at the horrified expression on Hale's face. "Oh, this super hearing thing could be fun."
"So everybody ready for tonight?" Laura asks.
She slides her plate toward Rodney, who wordlessly accepts the half-eaten slice as if it's his due. In his mind's eye, John can see them swapping out MREs and different flavored power bars in the field, bickering over the last muffin at team breakfast.
"It took John 3 hours to find his dress uniform yesterday,"
Rodney snorts.
"Real nice."
John kicks half-heartedly at Rodney's sneakers.
"You're the one who stowed it in the underfloor storage of Jumper 2.
"Well, I knew you'd need it, and it's not like we have a decent dry cleaner in the neighborhood," Rodney says.
"Sonic cleaning is terrible for creases. I didn't want to be tempted, is all." "Dress blues are nice."
Laura shares a wicked grin with Rodney.
John feels his cheeks redden to match his ears.
Ford makes a disgruntled noise, but keeps eating his cake. Aiden would continue eating his cake if the walls came tumbling down.
"Exactly. Nobody wants General Shepard here to have any not-so-mysterious stains today."
There's a sudden commotion from the kids' table. Stiles and Madison are laughing at Derek, who's covering his ears and staring at John's table with a horrified expression. Calliope and Kavya are poorly concealing smiles while drinking coffee and tea, respectively.
"That's what you get for eavesdropping, kid,"
John says, not raising his voice.
Derek scowls at him, but removes his hands from his ears. "Oh, yeah," Laura laughs. "You guys are going to be much more fun about this than Aiden."
After 10 minutes of Rodney's gaze boring a hole through his back, John's patience wore out.
"What are you staring at?"
"I've never actually seen you in those before," Rodney said, sitting on the edge of their bed.
He was fidgeting, foot bouncing against the hand-woven rug Taylor gave them as a housewarming gift.
"Sure you have,"
John replied, fitting the last buckle into place.
"The dress uniform was always more trouble than it was worth. But the brass from Homeworld's command were conducting an inspection, and Woolsey had insisted.
Rodney got away with throwing a lab coat over whatever stained slogan t-shirt he happened to be wearing because, well, because he's Rodney. I mean, yes, but not, and not since Rodney's voice cut off. When John turned, Rodney was resolutely staring at the floor, his face flushed pink.
Really?
John asked, with raised brows and a broad grin.
Oh, shut up, Shepard.
Rodney buried his face in his hands.
No, McKay, I get it.
John laughed, walking the few steps between the dressing table and the bed.
You love a man in uniform. Don't be ridiculous.
Rodney scowled, lifting his face to glare with as much vehemence as possible.
I'm always around men in uniforms. If that's what did it for me, I'd be walking around with a constant case of blue balls. It would be a parade of awkward boners and me running face first into walls. It's not the uniform. I just love you.
They both froze.
John was afraid to breathe for a moment.
I mean, I just love you in uniform,
Rodney said, voice panicked and half an octave higher than normal.
No takebacks, Rodney,
John said, leaning down to rest one hand on the mattress. He used the other to push on Rodney's chest until he was lying flat on his back.
That's real mature, John,
Rodney said, sagging against the bed with an embarrassed expression.
God damn it, Rodney. I love you too, asshole,
John said, climbing up on the mattress.
Oh.
Rodney's eyes widened.
Oh, good then. Yeah, real good.
John laughed, ducking down to kiss the ridiculous smile off Rodney's face.
I don't see why everyone is acting like we're dying or moving to another galaxy or something.
Rodney complains, slipping a blue silk tie around his neck. He turns from the bathroom mirror and tilts his head back, letting John tie a perfect double Windsor.
I'm pretty sure those were both more likely than what's happening, buddy.
John smiles, smoothing a hand along the length of Rodney's tie. He flips the shirt collar down, getting both sides as even as possible.
Yes, well,
Rodney's voice trails off.
I spent too many years trying to fix this ridiculous galaxy. I wasn't going to run away just because of a little heart attack, now was I?
John closes his eyes and takes a shaky breath, hands curling into fists around the lapels of Rodney's suit jacket.
Hey,
Rodney's hands wrap around John's wrists, and he tilts his head forward until their foreheads are pressed together.
None of that, John. None of that. I'm fine.
Yeah, now,
John replies, voice a harsh whisper in the still room.
You don't ever get to do that to me again, Rodney.
That's rich, coming from General Kamikaze over here.
Rodney's grip tightens infinitesimally.
It's been a long time, and it's not the same, John says.
When he opens his eyes, Rodney is staring at him in that painfully open way that always makes John feel like his heart might fly out of his chest. I know, Rodney says simply. Never again.
Never again.
They stand like that, waiting for John's breath to slow and sink with Rodney's. They're interrupted by a knock on the door.
You assholes better not be making any mysterious stains right now,
Laura calls from the hallway.
John laughs, a weak, wet-sounding thing,
and unclenches his fists from Rodney's jacket.
I can't believe I thought I missed you, Harridan!
Rodney shouts back, releasing John's wrists. His gaze is firmly fixed on John's.
Ready?
For you?
John slips his hand into Rodney's cool, dry grip.
Always.
The corner of Rodney's mouth tugs upwards to the familiar half-smile.
Always.
And I thought, perhaps, it would be good for us to attend the Harvest Festival on Gewura next week, Tayla said, adding a precise spoonful of sugar to her tea. They've recently discovered a rich vein of naquadah in the mines to the north of their capital. A goodwill mission would not be out of place.
Isn't Harvest Festival code for alien orgy at which we'll attempt to seduce your military commander?
Rodney asked, without looking up from his tablet. It was the first time he'd spoken since sitting down. He'd spent the meal so far shifting restlessly in his chair and picking at the remains of his eggs and bacon.
I'm almost positive that's how the linguists have been translating it in their reports.
Sounds like a good idea, Taylor.
John nodded,
ignoring Rodney. I'll take it to Lorne, see what he thinks.
You feeling okay, McKay?
Ronan asked, around a mouthful of breakfast burrito. Are you feeling well, Rodney? Taylor asked, brows furrowed. You have barely touched your breakfast.
Fine, just a little nausea. It'll pass.
Rodney took a large gulp of his coffee.
You've been rubbing your neck like that all morning.
John frowned and nudged Rodney's foot with his own.
Rodney had been unusually quiet all morning. Plus, he looked a little pale and sweaty since they sat down.
It's nothing, John, just a little sore,
Rodney snapped.
Probably from the ridiculous calisthenics you think are appropriate for a man in his 60s.
Gotta keep in shape if you want to stay in the field, old man,
Ronan said.
Oh, yes! Thank you very much for that pearl of wisdom, Ronan.
Rodney paused, still pointing an accusing finger in Ronan's direction.
Oh, that's...
Rodney?
John put a hand on Rodney's shoulder.
John,
Rodney turned to him.
I love you, and you should probably call for a medical team. I'm having a heart attack.
Then Rodney passed out and nearly slipped from his chair. After that, there was a lot of shouting and medical equipment and pacing in the infirmary waiting room. John doesn't really like to think about it. From a logistical standpoint, John understands why Sergeant Major Campbell chose the West Pier for the change of command ceremony. It's one of the largest, and there's probably some sort of important symbolism to the exchange of power happening during the sunset. John's never been big on the whole pomp and circumstance side of service, but he gets that it's important to his men. The Atlantean Marching Band, a ragtag group of expedition members and Athosians playing whatever instruments they've dug up, or in some cases, made themselves, is tunelessly making their way through a collection of folk songs as the crowd gathers. On the raised dais, Chucks gathered an array of flags for display. Every expedition member's country is represented, as well as the various organizations and allies associated with Atlantis. The central flags are the expedition flag and that of Homeworld Command. John, Rodney, and Evan Lorne sit on one side of the podium. On the other side, Ford, Madison, and Miko Kusanagi, who's tightly clutching a tablet, are standing at attention. Ronan flanks Taylor, who's adjusting the podium microphone for her opening address. She smiles out at the silent crowd as the sky turns bloodied orange at her back. Friends, colleagues, allies, and honored guests, we welcome you to this, an hour and a day we thought might never come. Her voice rings loud and clear across the pier. 30 years ago, the Atlantean expedition first stepped through the Ring of the Ancestors and into this galaxy. You were scientists and soldiers, with the hearts of explorers beating beneath your breast. You knew not what danger lay in wait,
But this knowledge never kept you from your goals. Your fear never stopped you from helping those in need. You came as strangers. You remain as dear friends. Her eyes dart towards John, Rodney, and Evan. As family. Over the years, this expedition, this thriving city, has seen many achievements. They range from the vital and mundane to the truly extraordinary. And yet, we have also seen great loss. A long-departed friend, Dr. Kate Heitmeyer, told me of a tradition amongst the peoples of Earth. I ask that you join me in a moment of silence for all the brave men and women we have lost. As one, the assembly bow their heads. The only sounds come from the birds wheeling overhead, the lapping of the waves below, and the gentle weeping threading through the crowd. The silence is broken by the Atlantean marching band, playing an almost recognizable rendition of General's March. Judging by the smug look on Rodney's face, Joan can make a good guess whose idea that was. Taylor gestures for John to take the podium. Her Athosian greeting gives John a moment to focus on the sweet smell of her hair, instead of the clogging of his throat. She retreats to stand at Ronan's side, leaving John alone at the microphone. It's at this point in the proceedings that I would traditionally conduct an inspection of the troops, John says, fingers tapping against the lovingly crafted driftwood of the podium. Kanan spent the better part of a month building it, so John hopes they find it a permanent place. But I think we all know how much I enjoy tradition, so... And that gets him a decent bout of laughter. So we'll skip ahead to the important bit. Evan, Rodney, would you join me? Once they're standing to his left, John straightens as best he can and digs through decades of training to bark, "Attention to orders!" The entire assemblage straightens like their spines have been replaced with steel rods. John barely keeps a straight face when he hears Rodney's amused snort. To General Evan Lorne, Atlantean Expedition Commander. And John can never thank Lorne enough for taking that particular bullet. On this day, May 1st, 2034, an order is given. You are hereby requested and required to relinquish command of Atlantis to Dr. Miko Kusanagi, former Deputy Head of Science, as of this date. John's glad that someone from the old guard is staying in charge. Miko was first wave, plus she has the gene. He trusts her with his city. And anyway, after 30 years, she's more than earned it. Signed, General Samantha Carter, Homeworld Command. Lauren steps forward and places his right hand on the tablet Miko's holding in trembling hands. She offers him a watery smile before tucking the tablet under her arm and shaking his proffered hand. Lauren leans forward and whispers something in her ear that has her blushing and laughing before he steps back. The city of Atlantis is now under command of Dr. Miko Kusanagi. Lauren nods. Miko manages a near-textbook salute and replies, "I relieve you, sir." "I stand relieved." To Dr. Rodney McKay, Atlantean Head of Science. John doesn't dare turn to look at Rodney right now. On this day, May 1st, 2034, an order is given. You are hereby requested and required to relinquish command of Atlantis's science divisions to Dr. Madison Miller, former Deputy Head of Science for Stargate Command, as of this date. Signed, General Samantha Carter, Homeworld Command. When John can't help it any longer, he turns to watch as Rodney hugs a softly weeping Miko. They're murmuring to each other in heavily bastardized French, because Rodney's Japanese is terrible, and Miko always says that English is the most emotionally constipated language in two galaxies. Rodney pulls away,
slapping a hand on the tablet with more force than necessary, before turning to his niece. Madison is studying Rodney in that fondly exasperated way she inherited from Jeannie. John's heart breaks a little bit, knowing she couldn't come, what with Caleb recovering from an emergency appendectomy. Jeannie's already promised, threatened more like, to visit in a few weeks, but it isn't the same. The science divisions of Atlantis are now under the very capable command of Dr. Madison Miller, Rodney says. He moves to salute, but she smacks his hand down and wraps him in a gentle hug. Thanks, Uncle Rodney, she mumbles against his shoulder. Stepping away, she adds, I relieve you, sir. Rodney rolls his eyes and straightens his tie with a soft huff. I stand relieved. Then Rodney takes John's position at the podium. He places a warm, steadying hand at the small of John's back, and John can breathe easy again. To General John Shepard, Atlantean military commander, on this day, May 1st, 2034, an order is given. You are hereby requested and required to relinquish military command of Atlantis to Colonel Aiden Ford, former deputy commander of Stargate Command, as of this date. Signed, General Samantha Carter, Homeworld Command. John places his hand on Miko's tablet, meeting her warm gaze with the most reassuring smile he can muster. They're the best and the brightest. They'll love and take care of his city. He knows it deep down in his bones. The military of Atlantis is now under the command of Colonel Aiden Ford, John says, saluting Ford. Ford precisely returns the salute, and for a moment, all John can see is the curly-haired kid who first tumbled through the gate and fell in love with John's D.O. I relieve you, sir. I stand relieved. After a beat, he adds, Hey, Chuck, it's about time for the party now, right? So, Rodney said, not looking up from his monitor, I've sent Sam my notice. John, who'd been sitting at a lab table and happily munching away at one of those weird kiwi apples from P4J338, froze. John lowered his hand, setting the fruit down. You did what? I'm resigning as head of science, effective the first of next month, Rodney replied, spinning in his desk chair. You heard what the baby voodoo shaman said, John. Plus, I sent my files on to Carson because he has a modicum of intelligence and the ability to grow some semblance of facial hair. Another heart attack could be the big sayonara. My job's a lot easier now that the Wraith aren't threatening to rain destruction down on our heads, but it's not exactly stress-free. This is... John had to force the words around the lump in his throat. Don't you think this is something we should have discussed? John, I thought you'd be happy. Rodney frowned, tilting his head to the side and studying John with narrowed blue eyes. Happy? And John's ears were ringing. He felt sort of lightheaded. Happy that you're leaving me? Rodney, what? Oh, chew! Rodney leapt to his feet, or as close to leaping as Rodney could get these days, and moved to stand between John's parted knees. You thoroughly ridiculous man! Rodney took John's face in his hands and gave a decisive shake of his head. God, you truly insane human being. I could never leave you. Never. Not for a million Nobels. John, are you listening to me? John nodded. Ugh, madness. I'm retiring here. Sam granted me special dispensation by having me sent on as a consultant. Oh, John replied, breathing in deep gulps of air, dizzy with relief. Well, that's good then. Much better for you, you know. He placed a gentle hand on Rodney's chest, next to where he knew the scar was. My, you know, John?
Rodney let his hands slip down to rest on John's shoulders. I thought it might happen one day, but clearly that was folly, since you're never going to get any better at the words thing, are you? Probably not, John answered, wry grin twisting his mouth. Sam, she offered you the same deal, if you want it, Rodney added, eyes fixed at a point on the far wall. I have absolutely no opinion whatsoever on the matter.
That would literally be a first.
Oh, ha ha!
You think I'm getting a little old for this gig?
John asked, eyebrows raised.
You're the spryest 63-year-old I know,
Rodney said.
They never call young guys spry,
John frowned.
No. No, they don't.
Who have they got in mind to take over the department?
Rodney's eyes returned to John's face.
Maddie. You're kidding.
Rodney shook his head, smile widening.
Nope, her team signed on. Wait, so that'd mean Ford... Would that mean Ford and Laura are coming back?
Well, see, that bit's sort of up to you.
Of course it is.
Because they're classy out here in the wilds of Pegasus, the retirement party is less a dignified affair in what passes for the Atlantis ballroom, and more of a beach kicker on the mainland. Ronan and a couple of the Marines have built a bonfire so big, John knows they stole some of Roddick's experimental accelerant from the chem lab. It's possible, but unlikely, that Roddick gave them permission, since Zelenka is a known sucker for Ronan's pleading face. This is made obvious by the fact that Ronan somehow talked Roddick into joining the circle of dancers on the far side of the clearing.
The mess staff have outdone themselves. There are tables overflowing with delicacies, ranging from a Thosian tuttle root soup to a chocolate fountain rigged up with a miniature knockwood generator. Further into the tree line, small wreaths of smoke circle a crowd of partygoers enjoying... Well, it's not John's job to know anymore.
Are they playing Air Force song?
Lauren asks, tipping back an earthenware mug of a Thosian ale. John squints in the direction of the Atlantean marching band. They're down to a couple of techs playing beaten-up brass instruments, one of the Cadman Ford twins on ukulele, Chuck with bongos, and he definitely didn't have those at the ceremony, and Torin on a kokia he borrowed from Miko.
That or Sweet Georgia Brown,
John decides, leaning back against Rodney's legs.
You really shouldn't be sitting on the ground,
Rodney chastises, left hand absently petting John's hair.
It can't possibly be good for you.
I think your husband's calling you old, Shep,
Laura laughs from the next log over.
I think you're right,
John says, tilting his head up to frown at Rodney.
He looks pretty funny upside down. I've maybe had a little too much of... this.
He indicates his empty mug.
How many was that?
I really don't know when you turned into such a lightweight.
Rodney sighs, deft fingers tracing whorls and swirls through John's scalp and down the back of his neck.
I'm one of the designated drivers, so we can head back in Jumper 6 if you want to head home.
You know my feelings about Jumper 6,
John says, turning his head so his cheeks resting against Rodney's knee.
He still has a thing about the damn gate ships,
Ford laughs.
They're jumpers,
John corrects, scrambling upright.
And they're all different, okay? I don't trust a ship that prefers Rodney at the controls.
Hey!
Rodney gives John a gentle kick to the thigh. I can hear you.
I know, and you should agree, because you know you can't fly in a straight line,
John says.
That's... okay, fair.
Rodney sighs. Does that mean you don't want to go home?
Nah, let's go.
John lets Rodney haul him to his feet.
Hey.
he adds, nuzzling at Rodney's neck before he's wrestled around and shoved in the direction of the jumpers.
We'll see you guys tomorrow.
Rodney waves to the group around the fire, who offer cheery goodbyes and raised mugs in farewell.
Come on, drunkie.
The jumper ride is uneventful. Their flight path is very nearly a straight line, thank you very much. And Rodney lands in the bay with a minimum of fuss. They take a transporter to their floor and stumble their way to their quarters.
Hey, Rodney,
John says, sitting on the bed and letting Rodney take off his boots.
Yes, John?
Rodney is clawing his way out of the sweater Radek knit him for his last birthday. It's a hideously striped monstrosity, and the warmest item of clothing he owns. He misses the laundry basket by a few feet, and couldn't care less.
Today was a pretty good day, wasn't it?
And he's looking at Rodney with such wide, hopeful eyes. Rodney's known this idiot for 30 years, and he's still the most beautiful thing in at least 2 galaxies.
Yes, John. Yes, it was a pretty good day. Bedtime now. Okay. You want to be the big spoon? Sure. Night, Rodney. Good night.
Rodney doesn't even complain that they're still mostly dressed and haven't brushed their teeth. If that's not love, he doesn't know what is. The end.
Daydreamer, with eyes that make you melt. He lends his coat for shelter, plus he's there for you when he shouldn't be. But he stays all the same, waits for you, then sees you through.
Reader's notes.
I don't even have words for how much I loved everything about this. It's a future fic where everyone is still happy families on Atlantis and they're still saving the day, even though they're older and they have, like, the marks to prove it and everything is beautiful. And then there's a changeover, but they still get to keep their city. Oh, and then, of course, Styles and Derek are going to have adventures in Pegasus Galaxy and it's going to be so great. I mean, part of me is, like, secretly wondering how they got rid of the Wraith, and part of me is, like, does Derek's werewolfism react differently to foreign moons? And part of me, actually, when I was recording this, I was reading Laura Cadman, and I kept thinking, like, for a sec, like, there would be this weird disconnect and be like, wait, Laura Hale? And now I want an AU where Laura Hale is an SG anybody, Stargate Atlantis or Stargate SG-1, but she's involved in Stargate Command and is badass, because for a character who, you know, died in the first 2 minutes of season one, Laura Hale is probably one of my favorites. And, of course, when Styles has to send letters home to his dad and Scott and Lydia and Erica and Boyd, because Erica and Boyd aren't dead, and, like, he and Derek are doing the little video chats home, but they can't say, oh, we're in another galaxy, so they're like, we're fine. Guess what Derek and I did today? We had adventures! And it's super adorable. And, basically, Talia Hale wrote the crossover AU of my dreams, and I loved it to bits, and I'm crossing my fingers and hoping eventually there's a story number 4 in the series.
The cover art for this podfic was put together by the amazing, fantastic, mind-blowing, I think we're at mind-blowing right now, Green Iron, who managed to find the perfect pictures of old men in love, John and Rodney, complete with, like, gray hairs and, oh, it's just so great. And then there's, like, the stained glass of Atlantis, and it's absolutely everything my brain imagined. And then Green Iron made it a thing I could look at and just, ugh, I think I might die from feelings. So don't forget to leave Green Iron some love for the absolutely amazing cover art. Thanks for sticking around to listen to this, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Like, there was literal foot clapping because I couldn't clap my hands because it was too close to the mic. Just, ah, beautiful. And John and Rodney being old together and still good for each other, my heart. So yeah,
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it, and have a nice day.
Can tell that he'll be there for life.
Extra reader's note. The cover art for this pod book was put together by the fantastic Green Iron, who somehow managed to take all the crazy crossoverness of this story and simplify it down to, like, the most simplistic, basic, easily recognizable images of the running wolf, which is the Teen Wolf stuff, and then the ancient text, which was the SGA SG-1 stuff, and it's just... my heart... I love how the design is so simplistic and yet completely, like, in a way that makes you completely understand what you're looking at without having to interpret shit. It's just right there. This is what it is, and it's so great. Green Iron also did the covers for Curly Fries and Other Little Obscenities, Beneath an Unfamiliar Sky, and This Is Not a War Story. So make sure you leave all the amazing feedback for this hardcore artistic talented person of awesomeness. Yeah. So great. I love it.